welcome to the CG Pro podcast. This is episode 56 with Ben Baker. If you enjoy what you hear today, you can follow us at becomecgpro.com or in our Facebook group. So it gives me great pleasure to welcome Ben today. Ben is a seasoned professional, been in the industry for 22 something years, having worked on multiple continents, been vice president at HBO of studio services, vice president at Vice Media, head of department of Framestore, and very alive and active in the virtual production space, being a partner of Mesh VP, a production services company in virtual production. So Ben, welcome. It's great to have you here.
Thanks very much, Ed. Great to be here.
You bet. Well, as a way of continuing the introduction, I'd love to ask you a little bit about how you got started with all that. You worked on some really cool projects at some amazing studios in various different countries. What led you down that path? Were there some things that you experienced when you were young that made you always want to get into this? Did it happen by chance?
It's funny. I think I said on another speaking engagement that I always watched these shows when I was much younger in my career, and people describe this career trajectory like it was always intentional. And certainly my experience was it was kind of like a bunch of accidents that all happened very fortuitously. I'm Australian, so I grew up in North Queensland, Australia. My high school guidance counselor wouldn't have known of any of the jobs I've had in my career. I was an actor. I studied acting when I was like 19. I ran my own theater company in Melbourne, producing kind of, weird avant-garde work, Harold Pinter plays, like all sorts of things, mainly on my dole check. I was on the dole, and, me and a friend were producing theater, like really poor theater. And then one day I'd broken up with a girl, and I'd hit that point when I was 25 when I just like living on someone's couch needed a job. And a friend of mine said, oh, there's this website, it's got some arts jobs, you could kind of get something going. And I thought, oh, I'm going to get back to acting and I'd need something for a couple of months. I applied for one job, which was at a visual effects company. I later found out it was a visual effects company called Complete Post. And I hit there, and then from there, like that was late 99. And from there, like my life completely changed. Actually, over that millennium gear change, my life had just completely changed. So in the months between October 99 and then February 2000, I started on a whole new career. I was on the reception desk of this visual effects company, learning a lot. I'd produced before, so I'd produced theater work, and there's nothing harder than producing theater on your dole check,
right.
So actually, like, getting paid to do something was amazing to begin with. I could buy a bottle of wine at the end of the week. But also this world opened up where I was very much a receptionist doing client services, making people sandwiches, that kind of thing. But also, I think, I had a couple of key people who took a shine to me and would say, oh, Ben, come in here and watch this cut. Does this make sense? And there was a particular moment when I was still auditioning, and I'd had that experience of looking at someone's cut and making a couple of suggestions, or I really like this or that, and then I was going across town for some shampoo commercial or something, and I'd gone to the wrong place, and the casting director was like almost yelling at me, like, oh, you gotta go over here, not there. And I thought, what am I doing? I just want to get back to my actual job. And I mean, from there, then I was there a year, and they moved me to Sydney to basically run their facility in Sydney. That's when I worked on my first feature film, which was Moulin Rouge, which was an amazing experience. I worked with Baz. So in Sydney, in Darlinghurst, this place had a townhouse, and out the back of it was the House of Iona, Baz's huge compound. It used to be owned by the governor of Sydney. It has an unbroken view of the harbour. It's got a ballroom. It's like this, almost Victorian kind of house. And so I worked with Baz for like 6 or 8 months. I mean, crazy as well, like 14-hour days, 6 or 7 days a week, as much as you like whenever Baz was coming in. Absolutely loved it. Just really, I'd kind of been involved in commercials up until that point, and then that experience hit me like a ton of bricks, which was like, oh yeah, I want to get into feature films and I want to really do this. And that was, you know, that was a very successful production as well. And so being involved in something of that caliber as your first experience, like, it was mind blowing, you know? I mean, I was there with Baz and CM and mastering shots. You know, we were the last place to put our shots in before he went to Cannes for the premiere after he'd recut the film, like craziness, you know? So I really got the bug then. And, you know, in asking around, everyone just said, well, you know, go to London. And so I did. I was there in Sydney for probably 2 years, and then I went to London. And I was in London for 10 years. London, again, was like just an amazing experience. I mean, I'm Australian, so, you know, British people kind of are used to seeing Australians around. There's a very, you know, I mean, funny story. I got off the plane at Heathrow. I had somewhere to stay. I'd spent too much money in Thailand. I had about £80 to my name. I had to make £200 rent at the end of the week. So I literally walked down to the nearest pub, and I said, oh, have you got jobs? And he said, are you Australian? And I said, yeah. And he said, can you start now? And so that's how I got my first job. Like, that was very easy. And London was very good to me. I worked, I got to London, and this was in 2001. So high def mastering was just really going mainstream then. And I really thought, like, oh, that's something that I think I should be involved in. And so I made my early career really about mastering and restoration. And I'm talking about HD mastering from an interpositive or an internegative. We would get the interpositive from the lab, you'd rack it up, and, you know, you'd be playing out to HD tape at that time. And all the way through my career, it's this very interesting thing where I was both I was in place and kind of senior, getting on in my career enough that I was next to all the greybeards and all the, you know, the people who had worked in film for like the 30 years previous. But then I was also the youngest person in that group who kind of knew computers. And I'd be like, oh yeah, you're the guy who knows computers around here. What do you think of this? You know? And so, like, you know, they had a Telecine, and I think it was a Spirit. And then the Datacine module came with that, so you could get like an approximation of a film scan. It's not really a film scan, but you could get a transfer to data. And, you know, I was running a film restoration pipeline there. We do physical restoration. I've got a certificate from the University of Westminster on nitrate handling. I used to handle nitrate, do cell and emulsion side polishing with the white gloves and reperfing negative and like all of that. And so all the way through my career, I'd kind of had to learn this old school analog film thing. And then I was always the youngest guy who knew computers, who was kind of like, oh yeah, I think we could use that data cine, and then we wouldn't have to play it to tape. We could send it right into this. We had digital restoration by then, you know, and it was like we were playing it out to tape and then ingesting it back into the MTI, and we could cut a pass right there. And then so that work kind of grew, and I got a pretty good reputation. And then I was mastering everyone's films from around town at a little place called The Machine Room, which is no longer there. That's part of the Prime Focus now. And then, you know, one of my clients was Framestore, and Claire McGrain, who used to run that department, she now runs Company 3 on Wardour Street. But she called me up, and she was always my client. She said, oh, we want you to come over to talk. And then they said, look, do you want to run this department? We want you to show us how to put an HD pipeline in for mastering, so we don't have to sub this work out, and we'll teach you everything you need to know about digital intermediate. And I was like, yes, I want to do that. So I jumped over, and then that was stellar. I was there for 7 or 8 years. At the time when Framestore had really got the core technology down, had spun out their R&D department to make FilmLight, the company. And so they were commercializing the blackboards, the grading, the true light grading system, true light color management system, and film light grading system. And that was all base light grading system. That was all spun out of Framestore. So we were kind of client number one for that new company. And we had 70% of the market when nobody else had any grading suites, right? That was my start of Digital Intermediate. So it was like, go, you're meeting every team that comes into the UK to kind of bid, talk to them, whatever. I had, you know, a roster of the most experienced colorists in Europe at that stage. That was amazing, you know, and that really, you know, we were doing, and again, our capacity, I had 70 staff there. We were doing kind of 30 films a year, which, I mean, I think maybe one of the company three offices, maybe the one in LA has that, but nobody kind of has that capacity anymore to deal with that, you know. But at the time, and at the time it's all film scanning, dust busting, that kind of thing. So that everything I'd learned in mastering and restoration then got dragged into Digital Intermediate. Then from there, like digital cinematography started coming on. So we were putting true light boxes out in ice fishing tents in like 2005, 2006 on the Arri D21, on the Genesis, on, you know, on very early digital cameras. Then I'd been at Framestore probably, yeah, 7 or 8 years. And Walden was a really good client of ours. We'd done all of the Narnia films through there. And they came to me and said, well, we're doing the third one in Australia. Is there anyone like you in Australia? And I said, I can be me in Australia. So I went to, I went and was the kind of on-set post producer. I had to build a post-production facility in like 10 days in pre-production. They just shipped over all of the bits. And, you know, they said, oh, we've tested every component. We just haven't put them all together yet. So we did 18 iterations of that workflow in 10 days while Dante Spinotti is shooting kind of camera tests and everything. And we're screening them. And we finally kind of pulled it all together. Then we did an 80-day shoot. And that was really, you know, you're that's like a proper Hollywood, like five camera units, including a helicopter unit that's got three helicopters. They built a big war galleon on the side of the water and they're dive bombing it with the helicopters to get shots of the dragon. That was really crazy. That's from there, really then fun. It was, I mean, it was great. Yeah. And, you know, we had set up a unit. We were in the Gold Coast. We'd completely built out like a screening room, literally got the carpentry department to put up walls and everything. So there was a company, 1619. They supplied the Avids and they then sponsored me into the US to build a mobile services department. Because what had happened in that time, I mean, I think during that job, on the Jasperini brothers had released Onset Dailies, Colorfront. And that was really the killer app for digital dailies. And at that time, all of that film, Voyage of the Dawn Treader, was all shot on the one of the Sony cameras, the F300, I think, from memory. And then, you know, by the time that offer came around, it had all miniaturized. You know, everything could fit into two road cases. And we did some of the first Arri RAW jobs in the world. You know, we did a film called Gambit in the UK, Extremely Loud, Incredibly Close in New York. And then it was on, like nobody else was really at the level and had, like I'd just come out of 80 days with five camera units getting like thumped to bits, trying to keep up processing dailies every day. And so I went to, 1619 sent me to LA and I came back with five jobs. And they were like, oh, right, okay, this is on, you know. And then I spent 3 years traveling around the world, really, with a couple of guys going into hotel rooms and setting up dailies in some data center and some wherever we could. We wanted to be adjacent to the editorial because we were setting up editorial as well. And we just processed. So I'd be dropping into Shreveport for, and I'd be there for like, I'd be reporting to probably the head of post of the studio. Like everyone was very nervous. It's everyone's first digital cinematography job. I'd be reporting back to them, making sure the archive was good, and then just moving to the next job. And we did a lot. We did Tomorrowland. We did a fair few things for HBO, who's been a long kind of client of mine. You know, and then after that, I was post-supervising for a while, and that's when the opportunities came up. I was kind of consulting and doing enterprise consulting, and then kind of everyone who I consulted with wanted to hire me. So I did a big consulting gig for Vice, and that translated 8 months later into them saying, well, we're setting up a cable channel. Can you come in and just run, set up and run the facility that we're going to do all the posts? I mean, it was nuts. Like, we did like 8 different series, the first 4 episodes of 8 series in like 2.5 months, plus about 60 hours of remastered Vice material. I mean, that was Vice, you're just dealing with a volume of stuff, you know, and so having to get your head around, like, how are you processing at scale? That's really what Vice kind of taught me. I was working on the HBO show, so I set up their cable channel, then their news department, and built Vice News Tonight, integrated Vice on HBO, which was already going, into a news department, and then really set up Vice Studios in my final year, before then being poached over to HBO to run studio services. So that was amazing as well. You know, it's all amazing, of course. That was a great experience because it's HBO. You know, unfortunately, 2 years after that, I got AT&T'd out of HBO in one of the rounds. But I was a VP, so I had, you know, I was very lucky. And I think me being lucky is the theme among all of this. I was very lucky that I got enough of a package that I kind of thought, look, I could spend some time really focusing on virtual production and working out what this is. So that's when it started, really, was kind of summer of 2020. We were kind of doing stuff at HBO before that, in kind of doing testing and that kind of thing. But I managed to talk my way into the Epic Games Unreal Fellowship. I did that. You know, I'd never touched Unreal before. I know enough to be dangerous. I could probably edit your wedding video. You know, I can kind of get stuff out of different post-production packages and 3D packages. So I kind of just threw my all in, made the film. And from there, then a lot of consulting opened up because studios were really trying to work this out and just needed someone who had an understanding or at least a sympathy with the operators and the actual work to be done. I consulted for Disney Television, for Amazon Studios, for Ken and CDC over there. That was great. For construction, people building stages. And then I got onto Fathead, Eric Weaver's show, which was, you know, really the first time. I mean, Eric kind of approached me after the fellowship and said, hey, do you want to be the executive producer of this thing? What that meant really was I met the director. He had a script. Then we started, you know, and I just had to kind of work out how to do this. So we broke down the script, a lot of different variations. I mean, there was a year of pre-production in that before we shot.
Wow.
Just from the very nature of the ETC shows, you know. And out of that, I met James Blevins, who is my business partner in Mesh. So we got invited to set up the Francis Ford Coppola film, Megalopolis, and set up the virtual art department for that. And that's really where we had the idea for Mesh. We didn't go into that job with the company, but we came out thinking, this is going to be valuable. People that can break down scripts, that can do budgets and schedules, that can crew, that can approach vendors and really get enough out of them. And that's what we've really based the company around. We've called it virtual production line producing. But that was really just a way of, in a world where everyone was pitching everything, you know, you talk to any virtual production person and they have an LED wall and they do motion capture and they do avatars and they do blah, 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 blah. You know, we wanted something very specific to say, we're just going to do these things, break down a script, schedule and budget, crewing and vendors. Like, that's what we do. So the three things, the way that it's evolved, the three kind of legs of the stool for Mesh are, one, we do enterprise consulting. So going in, I do large scale budgets, you know, across a whole slate, breaking down films, working out like what the utilization, if you're going to build a stage and you've got a slate, like how much have you got to put into a VP stage? How many VP stages do you need? That kind of thing. And then we'll do like a 6-week kind of setup sprint on features where we'll get together, do just exactly that, the breakdowns, budget and schedule, crew, and really then hand it back to a visual effects supervisor usually, who can then knows, has the chops to kind of run it. Or then I'd stay on as a producer for the whole production and literally be sitting at the end of the brain bar calling, you know, what environments they're loading, what the lighting is, what the lens is, that kind of thing. That was a long way, a big answer, but yeah, that's me in a nutshell.
It was a very thorough introduction. inadvertently.
Sorry, I've used half our time already.
You inadvertently talked about the history of Original Face, just like you didn't want to.
I did, and I promised myself I wasn't going to.
At least I don't have to ask you that now.
No,
there's a lot to unpack there. Well, just as it's a question of, like, because you've done so many things, what's been your guide throughout the whole thing? How do you make your decisions of what's next?
My advice to a good friend that I got into Vice and kind of took over from me there was something that somebody, I can't even remember who said this to me early in my career, but said, look, with every job, just do one new thing that you don't know how to do. And then fairly soon people will kind of get the idea that you know how to do things that you don't know how to do, right? And I think that's the most valuable thing. One of the biggest benefits is just being studio adjacent in a lot of the work that I've done from an early point, even back before Framestore. I was HD mastering and there was a couple of people at Ascent Media in London. If people know London, they'll know, and we're all on the same street. We're on Wardour Street, yeah. Right? There were like three or four mastering. Oh, really? It's great street.
Yeah.
In the ship. Very well appointed. I'd always been kind of studio adjacent, and that kind of, I just developed a profile where people are like, it's like the Narnia people, you know, we don't know how to do all this, but we're sure Ben can kind of work it out if we just throw him in there. And that's kind of, you know, I think that's my greatest strength, is just being adaptable and flexible. I mean, I've moved around my whole life. Even as a kid, my dad's work meant we moved around every 3 years or so. So I think that led me to be adaptable. And I'm just curious, you know, I'm just really curious about, you know, I get asked a lot, like, oh, what do you think of this? Or what is there? And I'll do some research and then I'll come back. And then people are like, do you want to do that for us? You know, just recently, talking to someone about, augmented reality, and kind of prepared something and came back to them. And it's just because of my past experience, I kind of just know where the emphasis would be for certain clients and that kind of thing. And that ability has kind of kept me in good stead, I think.
So being curious, following opportunities where you're going to be exposed to something that's new that you can learn.
That's right.
And following you, things that excite you as well. I could hear that throughout your story, the things that you were.
Yeah. Well, you don't let you not knowing is shouldn't be the barrier, because, you know, now more than ever, you can find out very easily, you know, and it takes like 20 seconds to kind of do some searches and kind of pull some information. And then you use kind of the background and where you've been to kind of sort through all that.
So what's it been like moving into virtual production? How has your experiences in visual effects and production kind of prepared you for what virtual production is?
Yeah, it's interesting. There's been a number of waves. Like, it's happened like very slow and all at once at the same time, right? I think a lot of people that we see are still waiting for, oh, everyone's going to shoot this way, you know. And I know that a lot of people that we've been meeting with over the last 2 or 3 years are all kind of, any minute now, this is, you know, what they say is someday everyone will shoot this way. Well, we're hoping that someday is soon. So it has been like trying to pick up projects where you can and be of value where you can. And that leads you to, I mean, some interesting places. We did an engagement with The Daily Show, and that was all about, you know, tracked avatars and within that context, which kind of reminded me of Vice, really, of the Vice News, where you have like a pitch meeting at 7:30 in the morning and you come out at 8 o'clock and you're like, okay, we're going to shoot a segment at 11 o'clock in the morning and it's got to be on air by 6, you know, that kind of speed when applied to virtual production is very different to the kind of like, oh, 12 weeks to build your VAD environment kind of thing. And I think, look, ultimately, what we're talking about is real time. And I think that's what I've realized, even getting off LED walls, it's the real-time environment that's the most interesting thing, and that takes you in a number of different directions.
Yeah.
That takes you almost to games. That takes you to, you know, being geolocated within a scene so that things are reacting based on where you are within the environment. You're setting things up almost like a game where you have certain conditions where things move. I mean, in Fathead, we were, I think, the first production to put metahumans on an LED wall. And what that involved was, like, there's so much downstream work you need to do. Putting it on the LED wall is almost the trivial thing, like switching it on. Like, we were at the Amazon stage, beautiful, big honking stage, you know, beautiful processors in some other room down the hallway that could handle. And we put up like 40 metahumans the first day. But we had a little app that was built, which would cycle animations through them and everything else. And it's almost like that stuff is the stuff that I'm really interested in, that real-time environment and how that changes your preparation, how it changes just the way that you interact with actors. You know, we've all heard that actors are, you know, famously Christian Bale talking about how it was so boring to be on green screens the whole time. I think there's an emerging kind of, I don't think LED walls are the end. I think they're an output point. But I think there's really interesting things happening in tracked green screen at the moment, and with augmented or XR kind of layers in them, of putting stuff in the foreground and behind people and having people move around virtual objects. I think that's going to be huge. And having objects react to bodies, you know, that is going to be really big. And I think that will be, tracked green screen and that those kind of automations of real time, that will be far more people's experience than getting on a huge LED wall, which I think will be reserved for. It's like anything, you know, everyone asks like, oh, will virtual production save you money? Well, it's a high-end visual effects kind of tool. When have you ever heard that that's inexpensive?
Right.
Right.
It depends what you're comparing it to, right? Like if you're comparing it to
that's right,
doing visual effects at all, then no, it's not saving you money.
Yeah. But, well, you know, I mean, the way that ILM made the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park is cheaper than actually having to clone dinosaurs.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so, but it's, you know, but it's wildly expensive when compared to anything else, right? And so I think that's where it sits. I think that there'll be multiple levels of access point. And that's actually, I mean, at Mesh, that's what James and I are kind of more interested in, really. Top of the middle is what we say, is like, I kind of got out of my system the $200 million kind of show. I've worked on those shows. I followed the Narnia films around the world for years, you know. I'd like to work with, you know, I mean, we did, we had a great experience with Coppola. I've been Sofia Coppola's post supervisor. Deal with filmmakers like that who come in with a real, you know, real questions, and not about like, oh, you know, how close can I get to the LED wall, but they're really wanting to know about how they deliver the emotional payload of the piece, you know, and this is a tool. And you're, I think as well, we're far more involved in the creative conversation where we are than if we were trying to get on a Star Wars film. I love the Star Wars films, but I'd probably be carrying someone's clipboard on a Star Wars film, you know, whereas, you know, I know that we have great clients that really like want to work with us and really want to interact and get into the weeds on what it's going to bring to the show.
Yeah.
That's what's most interesting.
I've flexed between doing tiny projects all the way up to big $300 million movies too. And I think of it ultimately like them both. I wanted to punch up to that level and do things that were, you could only do with that much budget, but also, yeah, like
that's
you
right.
said, you could, the smaller things, you get more agency and creative control. And we're starting to see now more virtual production appearing, even in indie and individual use cases. So we had a student who made a film, Killing the Machine, and it was done in a small LED volume that was accessible with a small budget. And he did raise some money on a Kickstarter, but not a large amount of money, and it was he was able to use LED and green and experiment with all the processes. It's very cool to see people like that doing really, really independent stuff with it too.
I mean, I had a great experience on what would be a tier one film. Oh, we're getting a sound up. What would be a tier one film called High. High was about telecommunication workers who work 200 feet up in the air in these towers. And the script had, you know, they go up 10 or 12 times to these towers. So they had probably 30 or 35 pages out of 80 or 90 pages, which were, you know, basically a third of the film is up these towers. This film had gone through the directors, Tish Robertson-Daly and Jonathan Mason, had gone through the Sundance Labs, developed it there. I became aware of it when it got picked up into the Tribeca Unreal Unreal for Storytelling kind of program 2 years ago.
Cool.
And I joined them late last year. They were applying for a mega grant, which they got. And so we put together a teaser shoot. I've actually got a little slideshow. But this is the Disguise Accelerator volume. This is fairly modest. This isn't like a mega stage by any stretch. This is, I think, 30 feet across, 18 deep. Our requirement was to build a tower on, on stage. So that's what we did. Scaffolding and speed rail. It was pretty old school. Scaffolding and speed rail. The tower is constructed right within the volume, right in the nook. This is Rebecca Bookbinder. She was our production design. She was an art director on Mando. So this is through the DIT's monitor. We constructed, I had two guys, a supervisor and then a VAD lead, Nan Lee and Karush Pranaza. We built 40 square miles of pantry side and put it on the wall. The thing about this film is the safety requirements would be so onerous. If you think about it, they want practical snow and rain, so green screens out. You could shoot it on the side of a mountain. That's what Drop did, and shoot in one direction to give you some aerial views, but still you've got the safety and rigging. Our tower, these people were not 3 feet from the ground. Our lead actor was 6'4", and so he could step down off the tower, basically. We had a safety officer, we had everything. This, for this distance in the air, this is the amount of safety we needed. All of the rigging is actually costume. It's not even safe. We weren't required at this height to use safety rigging. And this is the result. That is the camera shot. And you'll see, this is an example of the minimal style of virtual production, in that we have built only what we required, because we pre-vised it and we worked out, like, we're going to put the camera here, we're only going to see here. And so Amy was quite confident using the pre-vis as a guide to build the side of the tower. And this is the vista we get. This character kind of hangs out here for a while, just trying to kind of get out of her own head. Likewise, this is our lead actor. This is James Yee. He was the main producer on it. I got a producer credit on this, but James is really, James has taken a number of films to Sundance. He's old school kind of producer, indie producer. And it was interesting for James as well to hear him go through and him to this is the camera shot, and we had, that's a practical light, but everything else in here, and it's a great story. Nan and Karush were building all of this, and we started off with, you know, a large scale aerial photograph with some topography of a ground kind of scan, but then fairly soon you have to build it up, because at once it's not a documentary, you know, and so there's a river down here, these mountains don't exist in the actual real location, but you kind of dress it because you're making a movie. We actually, all the lights were actually you know, Nan jumped onto Stable Diffusion and just made a dot pattern, right? Just a dot pattern. Great polka dots. Stretched it out, changed all of the white values to luminance values, and then would wrap that around geometry, and that's what the town lights were. And all of the town lights were on a fader, so the DP could literally go in and direct the volume of light that was coming off any of those towns. It could say like, oh, can you knock the town down 15%? And they would, you know, they DPs love that, you know, that that kind of complete control over the environment.
Yeah, very cool. Well, yeah, for anyone listening on the podcast and who can't see that, definitely go check out the video on YouTube. But I think you brought up some interesting stuff there, and a little bit of use of some machine learning technology in there. Are you starting to see that come into productions more?
In bits and pieces. I think, you know, I think we all kind of are on the kind of the line of like completely rejecting AI or completely going for it. I think I sit kind of in the middle and a bit rejecting it. But I think, look, I think I said to you this before, I don't think there is going to be unskilled prompt labor working in visual effects on films, because there are just far too many people who are actually very skilled at visual effects who can use these AI, you know, systems to augment what they're doing. And that I have no problem with. It's when people just like, oh, look at this wonderful thing. Like, I'm not impressed by your Midjourney, like Vista or, you know, anything. It's like, it's cute, you know, it's like using an Etch-a-Sketch though. It's kind of, I don't know, it leaves me cold, but I think there'd be great advances in visual effects, particularly needs a lot of AI in some of the most laborious kind of tasks that are out there. And there are still plenty of laborious tasks. Let's direct AI towards those and leave actual creative iteration to humans. You know, I think that's where I stand on it.
So, yeah, no, it's interesting. It's obviously a very hot topic that's causing a lot of ruffles in the industry and a lot of argument and debate, and I think it's interesting to hear the perspective of like how somebody who's worked through the things that you have, observing how much it's actually getting used, because I think a lot of the hype out there is about a perceived possible amount of usage as opposed to the amount that's actually getting used. And where
it's, I mean, it's funny, on LinkedIn you see a lot of these like, oh, I made a trailer, you know, I made a trailer for a movie, and it's always like the backs of people's heads over a Vista with the voiceover, you know, and it's not, there's no lip sync, there's no discernible main character. And I just go on and go, well, look, either these things should be evaluated alongside everything else, or you should just kind of keep them in some little special area. But if you're going to come out and say, look at this great trailer, I'm going to critique it and say, you're only using voiceover. That's like film school 101. Don't do that unless you're doing something really interesting with it. Don't do it, right? Don't have your entire trailer be voiceover. Are there main characters in your trailer? Is there any action? Is there? And most of them are not, you know. So after I typed this, you know, I'd kind of done this, someone under me had said, well, it's really a technical demo. And it's like, well, if it's a technical demo, stop saying then, oh, it's going to put visual effects operators out of business. You know, that's what I really object to, is that kind of dialogue. Because it's like, you've brought no skill to the making of this trailer because you fall into all the obvious problems when people make trailers, right? So, you know, even though you can get a very high production value, you still don't have the creative impetus and ideas in order to hold something that people are going to actually, independent of it being fascinating technology, does it hold my attention? Does it make me want to see the film? They don't, you know, not yet. Someone will. Someone, the Beck of artificial intelligence will come along and completely blow us away with two turntables and a microphone, you know. But until then, like, I want that person to come along and really, like, show us, you know, what this is all about. But I think that person will have skills as well. I think that person won't just like turn up from working in a supermarket and then suddenly, you know, be Orson Welles.
They're not going to click a button and be credited as the great director.
Well, that's the thing that I find really funny is this prediction that someday someone's going to make a blockbuster film in Starbucks just on their phone. It's like, if you had any idea the level of attention to detail that one of those big, you know, $200 million films, like the level of pixel detail that you have to answer to on those films is far beyond anything that, you know, AI can do at the moment. I can't see someone like, they don't like the door, replace the door. Oh, do you like that door? No. Oh, do you like that door? No. Oh, the red door? No. You know, it just doesn't work like that. You'd be marched out of the room.
Right.
You know, so, yeah, anyway.
It's a great, I think it's great to talk about it a little bit more just because there is so much confusion around the subjects and misunderstanding and misinformation that being real about it to me is the important part. Just being able to, as you said, look at something as if it's not good, it's not.
I think. Like, I don't feel like I need to give AI a pass just because it's new. Like, you know, my daughter does a video on her iPhone. I'm fascinated and, you know, but would I enter it in a documentary competition? No, I'm not going to, you know. It's the same kind of thing. Yeah. Maybe the next one. But yeah, that's how I feel about it.
I think VR fell into this trap a little bit as well with having a lot of technical demos leading the conversation as opposed to having the creative, which is what you're describing, is that this is storytelling and we're trying to move people's hearts here. We're trying to create feeling in another human, doing it through that. That's always been done by people with skill in storytelling. Just making decisions.
And skill in storytelling is kind of hard as well. Like
hard.
It requires a real discipline to it, you know. It was fascinating. I did a little small amount of consulting work in between Dawn Treader and then coming to the States with George Miller. And his whole production company, Dr. D, which is his visual effects company in Sydney, they have this really fascinating thing that they talked about. You know, they were always reticent to get into a purely technical discussion about their pipeline because it was always referred to as a story-based pipeline. And so the things that you do to tell a story took far more precedence and far more importance over, like, resolutions and that kind of thing. And even in a lot of the, I do a lot of presentations. I'm a board member of the New York Post Alliance and ran their education committee for a while. The advice I gave to anyone in setting up any events to do with our industry is do not make it about resolutions, about bit rates. You know, the last thing anyone wants to go and see is a bunch of guys, predominantly guys on stage, all outdoing each other with resolutions and bit rates and things. Where you get far more traction is where you talk about the relationships that you require to cultivate in order to hold the position, who you're immediately working with, who you're passing off to, what are the protocols there, what are the etiquette. Like, that is the stuff that we're really talking about something interesting there. Just talking about, you know, the technical. I used to go to a lot of those early, you know, early 2000 kind of visual effects things, and it was always, you know, some shake guy getting up there like talking about how he got 4K mats and that kind of thing. It's like, oh, this is dull as dishwater, you know.
I mean, the technology is definitely an important part of digital filmmaking, but what you're saying is it shouldn't be the lead, it shouldn't be the thing driving the storytelling.
It can't, because then you get a lot of videos with disembodied voices telling the narration, telling the action in narration and all of those things, you know. Yeah, the technology first is a real trap, I think. And I think it's a real trap for visual effects and post to constantly. I worked at a place and they love to do the visual effects breakdown and show people what they did and everything until someone pointed out, like, yeah, I mean, most directors, they might find it interesting, but they don't care really. They want to know, like, did the shot sell? Did it work in the sequence? How do people feel? Like, that's what you want. That's what I found. That's the conversation you want to get to with your client. Not like, do you have 4K scanning? Because then you've just commodified everything you do. And there's going to be someone who does 4K scanning cheaper down the street. But if someone understands that you have a personal reaction to this story and you can relate to it and you think, oh, wow, this is amazing. And, oh, the aesthetic you're using. And when directors hear that, they're like, oh, that person can support me in the goals for my film. And it doesn't matter about 4K, 2K, it doesn't matter, right? Maybe it might when your, you know, head of post-production from the studio comes in and says, how are you scanning this thing? What are you charging me? But those initial creative conversations are sometimes the most important in separating yourself out from the pack, kind of all running along trying to get the job.
What do you think about what's going on in the industry at the moment with all the strikes happening and the fact that there is a lot of change, and some of that's coming from AI, some of it's coming from the studio model, some of it, for me, most of it's coming from the distribution issue. But what are your thoughts on the current landscape?
I mean, it's interesting because I was at Framestore with the last writer's strike, and that was a very different temperature almost, you know. Then there was this new thing called digital, and, you know, and the writers were like, hey, you're making digital stuff. And it's companies like Vice doing short form videos on the web. The studios were kind of picking on that and experimenting with things. And the studios kind of said, we don't even have a business here yet. So just give us a bit of time. And the writers were like, okay. This time around, it feels a bit different because it feels like the studios have kind of been sold a bill of goods. I think everyone started on their streaming channels, and then Netflix had that thing where they dropped subscriber numbers and then their stock cratered by a third. And it's almost like the whole of Hollywood was like, what do you mean? Our stock is going to be affected if we lose numbers on subscriptions, you know? And then suddenly everyone realizes they've got a revolver strapped to their head. And I think that's kind of where we are now. We're trying to work out a business model. I think everyone's gone headlong into these streaming services. And also, there's two very different businesses here. There's Apple and Amazon. Apple is never going to really care about the programs that it does. I'm sorry, but they do some great stuff. But compared to like millions of sales, they say that like there's something like 200 million iPhones that are 4 years or older or more that are about to upgrade into the iPhone 15. So who cares what any of the film shows do, right? It's not going to move the needle on the company revenue. It's an interesting thing that they have to kind of give a brand differentiation. It's like Amazon as well. That's the same thing. Like, does it really matter if people are buying Prime to get fast deliveries on their household soaps and they've got the television show, right? So I think those two businesses are kind of different to then you've got the traditional studio businesses that have to live or die on their content. And they've kind of, you know, for a while, Christopher Nolan was saying that Warner Brothers was shutting down the best feature distribution network in the world, you know, and it kind of seems like they went halfway there and then was like, oh, wait, we still need box office. We still want, you know, like ancillary foreign sales and everything, because I think streaming will settle into something that it's not now. And it's probably like, we're going to have it bundled like a cable package at the end of the day. And we've gone full circle then, you know, that's what I think. And you'll be like, oh, okay, in my cable package, I can choose three of these. Which three do I have, you know? And depending on the shows.
Really, but forcing one single source to make all of the great content in the world is not really, it's very hard to imagine. I haven't seen it work, and it's very hard to imagine it working.
Yeah.
I mean, relying on.
Well, Netflix is kind of in the middle, right? Because they're kind of a tech business. They didn't have any legacy. stuff. They just careened. Well, the legacy stuff they had was sending people DVDs in envelopes, you know. And so they had a great advantage, a great kind of head start on everyone. And they're almost adjusting to the new reality as well. It seems like they're doing far more foreign language. I mean, that's the thing. I think this, what streaming represents is trying to have not just a single market in North America, but a global streaming market. I think that's where it has to go. And I think, you know, I think some are probably better set up than others. I mean, that's Disney's whole business, you know, international delivery. Max probably has a pretty good, they've got pretty good chops between HBO and Warner Brothers and Turner, like Paramount as well, you know. But I think as well, so what this opens up is, I think for independent producers right now, the world in terms of selling, doing limited sales, I think people, what I kind of hear from different clients is no one wants to do the 10-year deal with a streamer anymore, but they wouldn't mind doing a 2 or a 3 year deal and then getting their property back and then selling it to the next person, and being able also to do international and being able also to do DVD and Blu-ray releases if they want to. So, you know, I mean, at its heart, that's what the strike is about, as I understand it, is like this residual channel has dried up. And it was actually a pretty good business. It was actually a pretty good way of producers keeping costs off their books, because people would get payments right down the line rather than having to be sorted out right up front for the original production. But I think independent producers now could really benefit by developing property and shopping it around. You know, I noticed just yesterday that Aardman has done exclusive programming with Netflix and Amazon. And I think they've got something out coming out on one of the other streamers, Apple TV or something. So there's one production company that's developed a whole show for Amazon and a whole show for another streamer, and they're completely separate shows. But you can go onto a streamer and go, oh, what's the Aardman show on this one? Oh, yeah, it's the little sheep got Terry the Sheep, you know, or whatever it is, you know.
Sure.
And I think that's interesting.
Yeah, there's been quite a lot of talk around both AI and the distribution model being empowering as opposed to being something to be scared of, you know, being empowering to smaller teams and individuals.
I think as well, though, that the change into real time is bringing something on. I think we're witnessing a change in the type of content that people are. Like, there was some statistic I saw the other day, and like, you know, millennials or Generation Y or, you know, young people younger than me, there was something like 30 or 40% who registered that they don't have the attention span to watch a 90-minute film anymore. And they just put it out of their head, like, oh, yeah, 90-minute film, no, I'm not going to watch that. You know, they'd much rather watch episodic television, but it gets down to TikTok and that kind of thing. Now, you know,
a 5-hour stream of half hour chunks, but not one 90.
Or watch a 5-hour stream of someone playing Fortnite or Call of Duty, or, you know, I mean, that's what's really changed. I've got two young daughters, kind of 7 and 8, but then I look, other friends of ours have like teenage boys, particularly, they don't watch television. They don't watch movies. They watch Twitch streams. They watch YouTube personalities. They watch TikTok. That's what they... And they're spending 4 or 5 hours a day watching that. So what does that mean for something? And when you can have a platform like Unreal Engine that can literally make a game, you could make a movie in one direction and a game in the other, and there's going to be something in the middle which is mildly interactive, but then also you're able to sit back and you can interact with it as much as you want. You may have mass interactions of like everyone wants it to go that way, so it goes that way instead of that way, you know, like that stuff is only, and also the kind of augmented reality in your home, you know, what's the Disney thing, remembering, you know, when you're watching it, then you use the app and the waterfall comes out of the television and builds the garden around. I mean, I think that stuff is going to be huge for that demographic. And actually having live like Pokemon Go, but for entertain for a soap opera. What does that mean exactly? I don't know, but it sounds kind of weird and cool. Like, you know, that's what I think is going to happen, is that at the almost at the emergent end, there's going to be whole new categories of entertainment that someone who's solely focused on, like, you know, big budget filmmaking will completely miss. You know, it'll happen at a grassroots level, and then suddenly the youth of today, 150 million people will be watching that thing, you know, and then you'll be like, oh, that gets people's attention, you know.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. Well, what, I guess there's no crystal ball, but what are you most excited about? What are you most interested in seeing more of?
More people using green screen, camera tracked green screen with augmented reality elements. I think fairly soon you're going to be able to use something like, you know, an Apple beacon, put that on the floor, pin an object to it in your space so that you can get some real solid kind of, it can be really permanently in the environment. You know, you can set boundaries and things. And then I think you'll have geolocated actions that happen within that space as well. Like I'm kind of thinking about just doing a little test of just like a maze kind of environment, but it's all AR, and just seeing how you would shoot that if it's all AR and you're just in a big green screen room, and you know, you've got someone going through that. I think that's really interesting, that the walls would be kind of not there in real life. Like it's a kind of different thing, really, I think. And I think that's interesting. I mean, we're constantly trying to push the, you know, the fidelity of assets and the interoperability of assets. I mean, for us, a lot of the time we're trying to work out how you can use the same set of assets both in a virtual production pipeline with an LED wall endpoint, and then also use them in traditional visual effects. And I think that is the thing that kind of sometimes needs a bit more work, you know, certainly to do with materials and material selection and placement and textures and that kind of thing, having things being able to be interoperable. And I think that's, you know, it's kind of what people were, no one's talking about the metaverse anymore, but that's kind of what they were talking about, was having like assets that can traverse different packages. I think, you know, I'm not a really big crypto bro or anything, but I think that there is something about people being able to interact with something and then have something that they can display virtually. I mean, I am quite a large player of Fortnite, you know, and so I know the allure of like getting the John Wick skin and kind of, you know, playing with your friends and that kind of thing. And I think that will only intensify. But instead of just being like, oh, a skin that you buy for $3, there'll be an actual economy with permanence of item and singularity of items that you could, you know, you could do that thing where you do in Money where you write your name on it or something, and then like a year later it comes back to you. You're like being able to mark a digital object and it's a permanent mark on it that doesn't go away, it identifies it, you know, that kind of thing. I think we're only just in the infancy, but I think you've got to remove the kind of investment and speculation aspect of it, because I think that's what simultaneously turns everyone off and also just crashes these things out, because a whole big bunch of people tip into it just to do some kind of, you know, wait for the next guy who's going to pay more than I paid for it to, you know, that seemed to be the business model of all those things, is just wait for the next guy to come along who's going to pay more, and that's got a shelf life. But I think people will be very interested in that.
Are you dabbling in Unreal Editor for Fortnite at all?
Yeah, I've had a bit of a look. I mean, I got on there and like built an island, you know, put some tanks down, and me and my friends played for a while. And I am interested in doing, I mean, it's finding time. I've been very interested in, I love Matt Workman's studio environment. Actually, James and I were like, oh yeah, we should do a game on Unreal where you have your studio. It's like, oh, Matt Workman just did it like on day two when it was released. He had it out already. And it was really cool. And you go into the studio and move a camera around and stuff. I mean, I actually pitched Felix from Felix Jorge from Happy Mushroom Narwhal while we were doing Fathead. I was like, someone should make a game where you're in a film environment and you can kind of move the table either into production or into the wall, and you have these assets and a little price tag kind of appears, and it tells you, like, if you move it further away, oh, you don't have to clean it so much, so the price goes down. And the game is actually to try and do this on a budget. So you've got like $5,000. How are you going to do it? You know, and how are you going to stage this scene? That, and you, I mean, you could do that in Unreal. You could do that in Unreal Engine.
Yeah, in theory, you can do anything, like a producer simulator.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. It'd be like Football Manager, but for Unreal.
Yeah, exactly. Is there anywhere that anything you'd like to share with the community, anywhere people can follow you, anything that you want you'd like to share?
MeshVP.com is our website. You can find us on LinkedIn. LinkedIn is where we do most of our posting and social media outreach. So yeah, check us out on LinkedIn. You can follow me personally. There's been a few, I've got an interview coming out on the W Lab. Have you met those guys? Tommy Wu and those guys from W Lab? They're the bunch of NYU graduates who have kind of got a space out at Tisch, and they've set up a volume, and they're probably doing more virtual production than anyone else in New York at the moment. They do a lot of music videos and everything. I got interviewed by them, so that's coming out pretty soon, and there's a couple of other things. We'll be at Unreal Fest, so oh, look cool. us up, and yeah. You know, we'll be down there sort of trudging around trying to work out what's what down there, which will be fun. Excellent. You're going down.
We'll be there too, yeah, so we'll definitely meet up when we're there.
Yeah, yeah.
Awesome. Well, Ben, thank you so much for sharing your time today. I appreciate you coming.
Ed, I hope it was I hope it was informative.
It was, definitely. Yeah, we covered a lot of ground there. You know, you're probably not your entire history. I'm sure there's more. But yeah, lots of really important subjects, and going through the state of the industry and AI and the reality and the perception of those things. I think it's been a great chat. I appreciate it.
Great. Thanks very much for having me.
You bet. Yeah, thanks for being on. Thanks for your time. And thanks also to all our listeners. And if you enjoyed today's episode, you can look forward to another one in 2 weeks and follow us more at becomecgpro.com or in our Facebook group. But yeah, hope you all have a great day and see you again in a couple of weeks. Take care, everybody.